Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Insert Here, a sex podcast where lust and learning meet. I'm your host, Kate Warren. Each week, I invite a new guest on the show to share their experiences outside the heteronormative or vanilla worlds of sexual expression. Guests bring a wide variety of gender, orientation, and sometimes racial experiences to life through their stories. They approach sexuality in fascinating ways and talk about how it's informed by who they are and what they've experienced. I invite regular people to share their best tools, tips, and tricks for communicating, thinking about, and of course, having great sex. Today, our guest is Lauren. Lauren is a cisgender femme lesbian from the DC area. She works in events marketing and leads women-focused pop culture discussion groups. She also reads and studies tarot, so she's out here living her best life. She is a lifelong feminist activist. Woo! And her passion is organizing individuals to explore identity and representation in the media they consume. She lives with two cats and a $20 vibrator. Today, she'll be debunking myths about the lesbian experience, how trauma challenged her notions of self, and the roles depression, anxiety, and body dysmorphia play in identity and sex. Welcome, Lauren.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Thank you so much for coming. You look great.
Oh, thank you.
Just to paint a picture for folks at home, Lauren is a fabulous, curly blonde with wearing a really, really summery fuchsia dress, and she is out here.
I am the peacock.
Yes, I love it. So you identify as being a femme lesbian. Can you explain a little bit about what that means? Well,
sure. Well, being a femme lesbian to me is it's so much more than who I am in a relationship. It's an identity as a whole. I embrace what is female in this world, and I just love
That's the femme part.
I love the word lesbian. It's just so unique and individual, and I had a huge crush on Xena Warrior Princess, and lesbian comes from Isle of Lesbos.
Really?
And for the Sappho connection there. Mm-hmm. And I kind of just love that I have a little piece that I can think of that has a little bit of history and a little bit of like poetry. And of course, you know, I think of Xena every time. So,
I mean, I think we should all be thinking about Xena when we're
every single day.
Oh man, that's awesome. So you've identified as a lesbian for how long?
I would say it's about...
Been out with that.
I've been out since I was 11 years. I had identified as bisexual from about the time I was 18, but I think I actually had a queer identity ever since I was a young child. I developed crushes on women that I would see on TV and movies, and I honestly developed crushes on my friends when I was, my friends who were women, girls rather, mm-hmm. you know, when I was a young girl and throughout my teenage years. So there was always something a little bit lavender about me.
Oh yeah, I love that. Actually, I've never heard that before. Where does that come from?
I think it's actually more on the, it comes more from like the gay male of vocab or canon. There was the lavender marriage, which is actually kind of a bummer. Those were marriages that a lesbian and a gay man would get into.
To each other's beards.
Yes. It's more of a bearding term. And, you know, there's always like the touch of pink. I think it's the pastels, which obviously, as you can see by what I'm wearing.
You're out here with jewel tones, not being quiet.
Yes,
which
exactly.
I love.
Yeah. I see it through the lens of color.
Totally. So, there are a lot of kind of myths, and there's a lot of fetishization of lesbians. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about some of those common things and your experience
like proving or disproving those myths?
Absolutely. Well, so there are a lot of myths surrounding like whether one person, the relationship needs to be the man or the woman, and that women are always performing their sexuality for the male gaze. And it can make for some unsafe spaces, and at least it can make for a really annoying night when men decide to insert themselves into an interaction you might be having with another woman.
Okay.
Yeah. But there's also women exist all over the gender and the presentation spectrum. So it's kind of annoying when someone thinks they can clock you when you have this identity that's as many shades of like gray or pink or lavender in my case.
Right. Totally.
as possible. Yeah.
So how do people typically perceive you?
Honestly, straight. It's
really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Until they talk to me or get to know me, I am very feminine presenting, and for whatever, people don't necessarily assume that any women who are interested in hair, makeup, nails, those things, if, you know, it's all on the first visual they see.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So how do you take control of that narrative if they're assuming all these things about you?
I am out as hell. I have a
rainbow. What does that mean for you?
I have a rainbow flag on my desk. I, when I'm in conversations that of mixed groups of people, I am not afraid to talk about my past relationships. Mm-hmm. And if politics comes up, I run into that portion of the conversation. I stand up and speak. And I feel like in a lot of ways, when a lot of people talk to me, because I present as I do, I feel like there's a little bit of comfort they have in like, maybe I can kind of like, you know, me to you, and they might kind of assume that they're talking to someone who's exactly like them. And I want to just remind people in my everyday experience that there's a wide diversity of people.
Right.
And also, I just share my opinions at the drop of a hat all the time.
No, I think that's great. So getting back to kind of the idea that you said men tend to insert themselves into your romantic or sexual experiences, can you give an example of something like that, and why do you think that is?
Well, so I think my favorite example of this is I've been in a number of conversations at parties, and when my identity comes up, or I say, and my girlfriend and I, or you know, this woman I used to date, and they're like, okay, usually they'll want a clarification, so you're bi or something, and you know, okay, I'm just to correct you, I'm not bi, I'm a lesbian. And then that's kind of like a green light signal. And I've had this question a number of times, and it's bizarre. It's, so you're a lesbian. Okay, so if the world ended and there were only you and a guy left on Earth, you wouldn't like have sex with that guy in order to like repopulate the Earth?
Oh my God.
And number one, no, because there'd be a ton of incest babies running around.
Yeah, that's
so why
weird.
Why would anyone want that? But it's just like, this is a weird place to insert your thought experiment, and also assume like you automatically put me in a situation where you're asking me whether or not I'd have sex with a man. That is bizarre. You wouldn't do that.
Right.
To a straight woman. No.
Or to a dude.
To a dude.
Frankly.
Yeah.
Be like, hey, if there were only two people left on Earth and one was a dude, would you have sex with that dude? Like,
honestly, I think they totally would.
Well, but also I think it's really kind of fucked up that they hear that you're a lesbian and that light turns green.
Yes.
And not red.
Yeah. And again, it's that green light. They'll talk about, like, they'll want to talk about my first time, if I've ever had sex with a man. And again, I think some of that is the femme presentation where they're just like, wait, no, there has to have been a penis in there at some point. Oh my God. this is kind of disturbing for me.
Do you think it makes them feel inadequate? They're like, we don't actually need your dick?
Oh yeah, no, absolutely.
Fantastic.
And again, I think a lot of it is like there's an entitlement to my life. There's an entitlement, I think, that
male privilege.
Male privilege, yes, that's what it is. Yeah, exactly. No, when you're a woman living in the world, there's automatically an entitlement. Your sex life, your desires, everything about you is open to critique. It's open to a quiz or an inquisition.
Mm-hmm.
And I do tend to get that a lot. I think another thing I get is a lot of like, I'll get a lot of fantasies from people like, I've always fantasized about that. Or, I've had I dated someone who was queer or bi or a lesbian, and I had a, you know, wacky time with them in bed or something like that. And it's just like, we were talking about Star Wars. Why are we suddenly talking about what is happening with either of our genitals right now. Yeah. Not that I'm not open to talking about those things, of course, but, you know, automatically it goes to that.
Right. Okay. So as soon as they hear that you're a lesbian, they're like, okay, green light, go. Let's talk about sex.
Yes.
Do you think that comes from a place of fetishization?
Absolutely. Yeah. Lesbians are, of course, hugely fetishized in straight porn, mm-hmm. which is consumed by a lot of people in place of sex education,
yes.
quite honestly. Yeah,
that's true.
And I think that there's this, you know, again, if you're not used to treating women as people, if you encounter, you know, someone who's part of your fetish in the wild, I can kind of see mentally why you'd think, oh, wait, I can talk to you about some weird, wacky thing I saw in a porn once.
You're like real life walking porn opportunity.
Yeah. Which, again, it would be flattering if this was like Christina Hendricks or someone like that talking to me.
Princess Leia, is that you?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my God. That would be amazing. But instead, it's just some dude who's got a growler of beer and has some opinions to share with me.
So entitled. I can't.
I know, right?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. That makes perfect sense. So do you get those same kind of reactions from straight women? Like, how do straight women approach you?
I think straight women kind of want to be in on the secret. It's sort of like I think a little green light goes off for sex too for straight women, but there can be, you know, in some of the worst cases, it's I've always fantasized about that too, or I need to talk to you about my sexual encounters right now. There's not so much fetishization there, but it's sort of I'm going to understand some of their deepest, darkest secrets, and they can collude with me on our rogue sexual identity.
It's interesting because I've definitely found that to be true in talking to folks about doing this show. Because I did about a year of research before we launched the show, and so I was talking to basically everyone I met. They'd say, "What are you working on?" And I'd say, "Well, I'm starting a sex podcast," and then immediately they would like lean in surreptitiously and be like, "Let me tell you about my gangbang fantasy." Right. Like, which, cool. You know, from a research perspective is great. Like, let me tell you, everybody's got a gangbang fantasy. Not everybody, but a lot of people, especially straight women. But they did like take it as an opportunity to talk about their sex lives. Mm-hmm. I think in large part because we don't have systems and spaces set up where we can safely talk about sex and share those experiences and be like, have you experienced this too? I have questions. Can you help me? And so hopefully this show helps fewer people ask you those questions.
And I mean, I think in some cases too, speaking to that, it's the first time when people talk to me, they're meeting a queer woman who looks like me or a queer person who looks like me and has the identity I do.
Right.
So
it's very accessible.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of questions out there, and you know, if maybe we were all open to different kinds of presentations and identities, we'd probably ask less questions or, you know, I don't know. I can't say what would happen in a world with no straight entitlement, honestly.
I don't know.
Or hetero entitlement.
I don't know. Well, and I think I think if people did have those spaces, they would be less quick to fetishize and reduce you to a sexual individual as opposed to a very layered, nuanced individual who, you know, has hobbies and dreams and goals and a brain.
Exactly.
And not just a pussy.
Yeah, exactly. I have one of those, but I you know, it does other things for me too. There's other ways it's involved in my life.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome. I love that. Well, so now that we've sort of set the stage with you as a femme identifying lesbian, can you walk me a little bit about your process of coming out of the closet, if you don't mind?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, I'd always had conversations with my friends and my mother. As I said, I knew that my orientation was not 100% heterosexual when I was growing up, and I'd had a couple conversations about feelings that I was developing. And when it's a very traditional gay story, I went away to college and basically came back our first break on our first semester and came out to my parents as bisexual, which is how I identified at the time. So I'm 18, mm-hmm. and I just sat down at dinner and was like, okay, I'm back for the weekend, and by the way, mm-hmm. and it was very, they had a little bit of fear in what they, expect in their reception, yeah, in their response, mm-hmm. but it was mostly, I grew up in Northern Virginia, which isn't the most
homophobic place, but it was homophobic, and it still is homophobic.
I mean, our culture in general is homophobic.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there was just a little bit of, we're kind of afraid of what would happen to you if something horrible happened. Da, da, da. And right. That's a normal parental fear. And about when I was 7 years later, I came out again, and it was more of a clarification. Just, hey, here's an update for you guys. I am a lesbian. And again, that was part of my, it was, for me, it was part of my process. Mm-hmm. It was just it's where I came to. And I certainly, it took me, hey, it doesn't take like overnight to figure out who you are. And all identities are valid at any time, right?
Right.
I mean,
totally.
Yeah, you can totally embrace them.
Right. Well, and it's interesting. We've had folks who do identify as bi on the show. Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of, there are a lot of conversations about like marginalizing
right.
folks who identify yes. fully as bi mm-hmm. and live their life that way completely. But there's a lot of pushback from certain people in the queer community about like, oh, bi is just like a gateway to gay.
Yeah, absolutely not.
Which is not
stupid.
True.
Yeah,
right?
Of course.
You know, anybody can exist anywhere along the orientation spectrum at any time.
Exactly. And I mean, it speaks to a little bit too of, everyone just wants to put someone in a box. Mm-hmm. No one wants to deal with that, the juicy, messy parts of when we're exploring our identities and when we're sort of like out in the world. I mean, you can have any experiences you like and just feel free to do them. It's just, yeah.
Right. So you came out as being gay to your mm-hmm. parents?
Yes.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much.
My process.
Yeah, no, it was a nerve-wracking process, but you know, I think they didn't fully expect it. And I think I think a little bit of biphobia played into it where mm-hmm. I think they may have been hoping for the door to swing the other way.
But that's
not how it was. That's not how it went. And, you know, I think I was just waiting to have that one conversation for a very long time. And they're very supportive. They've always been very supportive, and it's a little bit not what they expected. Again, it's hard when you have a child, I think, to find that they're their own person.
They are, and you raise them to go off into the wild on their own.
Yeah, and I imagine that's very scary.
Sure, of course. They say it's like having your heart outside of your body.
Oh my God, that's very scary.
Oh, it feels.
Oh, it feels.
Yeah, totally. Yes. So you came out, mm-hmm. and that's amazing. What was kind of your sexual awakening, if you will, as opposed to your sexuality awakening, as opposed to like your orientation?
Oh, my sexual awakening. So it was again figures in pop culture. I remember watching a lot of movies with sword and sandal fantasies, like movies like Willow, and there's a scene late in the movie where a female sword wielder is played by Joanne Whaley, named Sorsha, is basically in a chainmail, like this chainmail top where you can really see her boobs, and that was like, yeah, it was really young, so that was when I was like about five. I was like, oh my God. There's something in this world that gives me all a tingle. Makes me all a tingle.
We're fanning in here.
Yes. Oh my goodness. And I have to say one thing: the first real person that I really, my first girlfriend, mm-hmm. honestly, I remember meeting her and looking up at the sky like in the afternoon and thinking like, oh my God, the world is open. I could see the clouds more clearly.
Aww.
It was really just like a moment of like true. Oh my God. Thunder, I actually feel like I could fall in love. I actually have this desire to be with someone else. This is amazing.
Awesome. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
How were your experiences with men during the time that you were seeing both men and women?
Not great.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, you know, attraction is an interesting thing. I have been attracted to men. And even sometimes now, you can be attracted to men. Does it mean I want to have sex with them? Does it mean I want to do anything with them? No. But I think anyone can have an attraction to anybody. It just gets thrown, I think because of biphobia, it kind of gets thrown under the microscope a little bit, like, you know. Anyways, but no, yeah, they were, I found out that penetrative sex is not my jam, mm-hmm. nor will it ever be my jam. Mm-hmm. And that was a difficult process as I was trying to navigate sex with men. And my early on, I found too, my interactions with men were not always coming from a really wonderful place. There was, I was taken advantage of by an older man at a job I had when I was a teenager. And you feel pressured as a young woman to submit to a desire of other people, the desires of other people, mm-hmm. to comply with the desires of other people without ever thinking of your own pleasure, without ever being on the same, without ever like really thinking of what it really means to you and your own heart. And that was very difficult.
Right. Well, I think those are conversations that we're having a lot more now mm-hmm. with the Me Too movement.
Yeah.
Being so much more mainstream, the power dynamic with male to female, with older male to younger female, can lead to like really pressed, traumatic experiences that are not, where you don't have full ability to consent because of the lack of equality in that power dynamic.
Right. And I remember for me and my own experience, it was really one of, I didn't know what I was going through, or I didn't know what was happening. I didn't know what my responses should be. And again, I was just very confused in general about what my place is, what my sexuality was. And I think I was very easy to take advantage of. I wanted to please someone. I wanted to experience desire. And mm-hmm. again, especially if you are dating someone under the age of 20 and you are an older person,
it's predatory.
It's predatory, yeah. And you never recognize what predatory behavior is when you are the younger person. You're coming into your own power and you're starting to feel things, and its hormones are all a blazing glory. And it's just
nice to be wanted. Like, it's such a basic human experience to be desired.
Absolutely.
And to your point, to want to please people.
Yeah. And I found in that case, unfortunately, I was taken advantage of, and there was some, it was a traumatic experience that I actually didn't even file under "this is sex that I had." Mm. I just filed it under "this is something that's happened to me. Does it mean that I also have does it mean that my identity does include attraction to men because this person did this to me and he's a man?" Mm-hmm. And it was very confusing and difficult to process for a very long time. And it, my other interactions with men were just, we'd get up to the point where sex was involved, and it was, you know, if it ever got to penis and vagina, it was sort of like a, speaking of lights again, the second any of that would happen, it was like, no,
okay.
No.
Yeah. Just like a guttural reaction.
And I mean, also totally off topic, but women always just have the pheromones that women give off just are more pleasing to me. Men actually smell not that great to me.
That's totally fair. And they say that like chemical compatibility mm-hmm. can be really indicative of like the potential success of a relationship. So if somebody stinks, like, probably look at that situation, because pheromones are real.
Yes, I know. And it also really, once I kind of followed through on that, like, well, you know, you don't like sex this way. You actually don't like men touching you anyway. That's mm-hmm. in that sense. And they smell bad. Maybe your body is telling you something. Listen. Maybe there's something there, and you need to start looking through your brain and categorizing, like thinking through why you feel like you need to please people or why you should keep pursuing this.
Totally, totally. So to pivot a little bit, we spoke before about kind of the role that anxiety and depression have played in your sex life. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So, I've been an anxiety survivor, let's say, for most of throughout my teenage years until now. I was diagnosed with major depression about 3 years ago, mm-hmm. and I'm currently medicated, and I'm in therapy, and I'm extremely happy about both those things.
That's awesome.
And they've helped me a lot.
Great tools to have in the toolbox.
Exactly, yeah. And it's been difficult for me to navigate sex. I actually was celibate for 14 years because I found that desire and being intimate with someone would give me anxiety attacks.
Really?
Yes.
Man.
Yeah. I'd be sitting next to a girl, and we were on our third date, and we're on a couch, and her hand comes to hold mine, and suddenly I get like the chest, the pounding of the heart in the chest, the dizziness, just everything. It would all happen. And
short of breath, vision blacking out,
yes,
all the things.
Yes.
That's scary.
It really is. And I mean, again, forget sex. Getting to that stage was just also very similar. And so everything around that, including dating, including even just looking on like, say, OkCupid or something, sometimes would just send me into a panic. And anxiety and depression kind of, they hold hands as they skip through your life. So yeah. The depression kind of followed. Depression followed that. Mm-hmm. And I would find, too, that if I was attempting to navigate an encounter, I would just feel I'd plummet. My nerves would first jangle, and then everything would just plummet, mm-hmm. and everything would go numb. And there would be a sense of like, oh, well, you know, I'm disgusting and I'm not worthy of this encounter anyway. I'm disgusting and not worthy of dating. Who would ever date me? Everything's terrible. Da da da. You know,
spiraling.
Yeah. Depression lies.
Yeah, it does.
And it's really good at it.
Right. Well, and anxiety sort of like hijacks, like kicks you out of the driver's seat of your own brain and like mm-hmm. hijacks your brain and then like crashes it into like the black pit of depression a little bit.
Oh my God, yeah.
Is that sort of what it feels like?
That's actually exactly what it feels like. And there's also a sense of, you know, you don't see yourself as a person. You just see yourself as this problem. You see yourself as like, as nothing. And, you know, it took me a while to get my diagnosis, but having that helped. And it helped me also to see like the ways it had affected other parts of my life and kind of pick apart like, you know, this is how I am during these encounters. Maybe those things aren't true. Maybe I am hot. Maybe I am someone worthy of love. Maybe I should be dating. Maybe this is worth it.
And right.
Yeah. But one of the ways that I dealt with it is, again, I eventually I just stopped. I stopped casually doing anything casually. And before I knew it, I was living a very celibate life, mm-hmm. and I grew to think of it that way. I just thought of it as a celibacy. Mm-hmm. I was not always happy with it. I'd say I, for the majority of that time of the 14 years, I was desperately unhappy with it. But, you know, that's also, again, my brain found another thing to attack for
sure.
me being less than.
Yeah.
But it was also a coping mechanism as well.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, because if sex was triggering your anxiety, like, of course you would try and remove as many triggers as possible, I
exactly.
would imagine, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I found, like, throughout those years, my only sexual partner was myself.
Okay.
So
how was that?
Well, one of the things I did discover over those years is I'm multi-orgasmic. 13 in a row, baby!
Congratulations.
Yes.
It's not about how many, but...
But, yeah, I am... I'm pretty happy. It's kind of like
That's
scoring
great.
In a video game.
Well, and then everybody has the ability to be multi-orgasmic.
Yes.
Men, women, kind of all, and all the gender identities mm-hmm. in between. But good for you for like putting the work in to build that part of your sexual practice.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And I found like over the years, like banking all that and even making sure that I
practice
made sure
makes
to...
perfect, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I even, like, made appointments to, like, have sex with myself. Like, I mean, it was, like, I did have my standing dates and things like that.
That's
it was
awesome.
And I found I needed to work on that, too. Because sometimes I'm like, oh, you shouldn't even do this. You don't even deserve this. You always deserve it.
You always deserve it.
Every minute of every day.
And whether you're celibate or with a partner or with multiple partners, I think that is a great piece of advice mm-hmm. to, like, set a date for yourself. You're like, I'm gonna give it to myself just the way I like it tonight.
Exactly.
Like, run a bath or light some candles or like put on hardcore music, whatever your thing is.
Mm-hmm.
and go for it. Like get your favorite sex toy out or use your hand of preference and some and some lube and like be good to yourself in that way.
And again, it doesn't take much money sometimes. $20, good investment.
Yeah, $20 vibrator. There you go.
Yeah. Amazon.
Oh man, it was interesting. A couple weeks ago, I hosted, just slate aside, I hosted a panel on female pleasure for Planned Parenthood. Mm-hmm. And as I was waiting for my car to come pick me up, I heard, you know, two women sort of talking behind me as they were walking out. And they said, man, I have so many questions and I haven't even had sex yet. And I was like, virgins. Wonderful. And
that's
so,
awesome.
And so, yeah, I know. I was so excited that they were there being proactive about about their own pleasure.
We should be our own first sexual partners. I mean, really, honestly, like, as long as... I think that's what sex should be. It's about, like, knowing yourself. And
well, and unless you can't... And this goes for sex and everything else. Like, if you can't be with yourself, you can't be with other people.
That's right.
And we have to give each other the tools to succeed in relationships, whether it's, like, emotional or spiritual or sexual in nature. You have to say, like, this is what I need, and this is how I would like... This is how you can help me with that.
Yeah,
sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So you developed your language around mm-hmm. self-pleasure, mm-hmm. which is amazing. How did you... And how long were you celibate for?
14 years.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
Good for you. That's a commitment to self-pleasure.
It was certainly a commitment of sorts.
Yeah. So how did getting your diagnosis change your perception of your celibacy?
Well, it definitely changed it for the better, because I was able to look at it less as though I was just failing for years and years to find someone, or I had some sort of inadequacy to... There are reasons that this is happening, and it taught me how to look at it through, like, a better lens of, this was good for you. You learned things over the years, and you have a lot, you know a lot more about what you want.
Yeah.
And when everything did change, so basically about, let's say a year after my diagnosis, I entered into a relationship, mm-hmm. and... It went very well, and my first time back at sex was amazing.
Yes.
It was just great. It was everything I could have possibly wanted it to be, and I look back, and
that's
I'm like,
awesome.
Whoa, this is something I actually feel like I'm back in the driver's seat, baby.
Well, exactly. That's totally it. And you did that for yourself. Like, you went and, like, got the help that you needed and built the tools in your toolkit to be able to get back in the driver's seat.
Yeah,
so again. Good for you. That's awesome. And it takes a lot of bravery to do that. So good job, you. we're gonna take a real quick break. And when we come back, we will continue. You're listening to Insert Here.
All the music on this program, produced by P. Morris, producer based out of L.A. Find his music at soundcloud.com/P. Morris. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. You are listening to Insert Here, a sex podcast where lust and learning meet. I'm your host, Kate Warren, and today I am joined by Lauren, a femme lesbian, who before the break was talking to us about how getting a diagnosis of major depression helped her overcome and reclaim the driver's seat of her sexuality. Welcome back. So I would love to talk about kind of the third piece of this, because we talked mm-hmm. about depression and we talked about anxiety. How does body dysmorphia fit into this?
Well, my body dysmorphia sort of emerged as well in my teenage years, along with that anxiety and depression. And the best way I can describe it is I would look down at my body and I would think, this isn't a human body. This is a series of lumpy mashed potatoes in a pantyhose. That's what it looked like to me.
Which is so untrue, because you are beautifully curvy and fabulous. Like, you are the woman in Renaissance paintings.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, again, it is fanning myself in here.
But it's true. Like,
yeah, it's just the same as, just as depression lies, body dysmorphia is something that basically you cannot perceive who you even look like. And it's informed by a number of things. It was informed by just... you know, fat phobia by
Our culture.
Our culture
Western
is...
Western beauty standards
Western,
are absurd.
Exactly, yeah. And there are so many different beautiful kinds of people and so many attractive kinds of people. Why would you limit yourself to like a fucking Maxim magazine or whatever the kids are looking at now?
Right.
But for me, it basically meant... just as I would get these panic attacks during encounters, I would suddenly plummet to a place of,
you're not even human. You don't even have a compatible body type with this person you're trying to get with. Like, why would you even make the attempt, you know, looking at yourself day after day? And it's interesting because it also, I throw a great Halloween party every year, and I do costumes that are pretty revealing. Mm-hmm. And it, part of dressing up for me was creating a body I wanted and creating the femme form that I thought I thought was possible. And over the years I was noticing, just, why do you feel that way about yourself only when you're putting on some sort of persona? Like, you could be this sexy every day, and right. maybe you are.
How do you think that was, that you performing this sort of idealized body of femaleness was influenced by that fetishization that we were talking about earlier?
I think for me, it's there might be some truth to that, but I think for me, actually, the place that it came from is I'm also seeing the woman that I want to have sex with. I'm seeing my own attractiveness in it. Mm-hmm. I've always been very, I'm not going to say that fetishization does not play any role in it at all, because, I mean, I'm just as affected by that, that the thing that happens to me in a lot of encounters as anyone would be. Mm-hmm. But for me, it was more about, there was an empowering and reclaiming to it that just wasn't, that just didn't happen with those encounters, or the sense of, I need to make myself into something.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So how did you push through that? How did your thinking around your own body evolve?
It actually went, again, hand in hand with getting my diagnosis for depression. And again, therapy is amazing. Everybody go to therapy.
Everybody should definitely go to therapy. It's like going to your doctor to get a checkup, even sometimes, like, and or going to the gym, right? Like,
exactly. Yeah.
Our bodies and our minds can be really good to us if we like provide them with the tools and the tune-ups necessary to keep working for us.
Yeah, and I found too that, you know, my attractive, me getting into myself, mm-hmm. a lot of that came back too when the healthier I was getting, the more energy I had, the more I wanted to like exercise or eat right or things like that. And it's not like, oh no, if that's what you're feeling, if you're feeling depressed, you just need to exercise and eat right. No, bitch, you won't start to do those things until you actually treat your depression. Those are not real.
Right.
But
it's putting the cart before the horse in your specific case.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But as I started taking care of myself, I started taking care of myself that way. I took care of myself in other ways. I started doing, I started doing yoga again. For years I ran long distance, and I just kind of started noticing, like, no, you've been putting in the work. Started eating less processed foods, things like that. And it was just little things where you get to a point when you're in that headspace, you're like, well, this is just a bunch of crap, so I'm just gonna, you know, I'll eat whatever, I don't really care for dinner. Mm-hmm. To a point where I was like, no, wait, I feel better when I eat a bunch of vegetables and a protein or something like that. It's right. When I make something for myself. And I've always loved cooking, so that actually, the more confidence I had, the more I was willing to express myself, too. More energy I had to do those things.
That's awesome. So it's this really sort of, like, this loop, this feedback loop.
Yeah. And again, it's, was I ever this disgusting lump? No, I wasn't. And in fact, actually, I think, I was definitely thinner during those times. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, my mind was not perceiving what my body really was.
Right. Well, and all bodies are beautiful. We talked about this in you know, our talk earlier this week. I used to be an art model in college because I wanted to better understand the subject artist relationship, and so I spent several years posing naked for artists, painters, folks who were doing like drawing classes, a lot of photographers, always very artfully, always very respectfully. And it really made me feel much more in my body and like, oh man, it's pretty powerful to have 40 people looking at you. Like, no matter, and you know, I was teased for being thin in high school. You know, I had a guy, like, I had, you know, folks be like, oh, you're an anorexic bitch. Right.
Well, you're an asshole, sir.
Right. Exactly. You know, it's not in any way having anything to do with my body. And mm-hmm. I always have had, you know, a fast metabolism and have to eat like six meals a day to try and keep up, which is really annoying.
I'm resisting the urge to say you're really lucky.
Well, but is it really lucky to have to spend all your time finding food, eating food, cleaning up food? Like, it's really a pain in the butt.
It's awful, but that's the way we're programmed.
Well, and I love my body because it works hard for me. Yes. And and when I feed it and work it out, it is good to me. And but what I found being an artist in those spaces when I wasn't the subject, when I was the artist, is that I much preferred to draw women who are curvy because I found their bodies to be so beautiful and so much more, frankly, like so much more visually interesting to me to draw. Because when you're in an art class like that, you're not thinking like, oh, like this person is like fat or thin or whatever Western beauty standard words we want to use. You're thinking like, okay, so the light falls on their elbow like this, and then they're holding their hands at this particular angle, right? You're sort of breaking them down into these beautiful little pieces, celebrating each one because you're spending all this time celebrating each one by drawing it or painting it or whatever, which I love. And I think I wish people could do that with themselves and with each other more. Yeah. Like, oh, like I tell my boyfriend, like, I love your ears, which is such a weird compliment, but they're beautiful, you know? And I love like so many other things about his body and compliment those things too. But I think that's a great example of like, this is not a sexual comment. I'm just really appreciating like the form of your ear right now, you know?
Looking at people as art and not just something that's like an object of desire.
Bodies are amazing.
You're a piece of art. Yeah, yeah. They do so much. Again, as you said, they do so much for us. They carry us everywhere we need to go. Mm-hmm. They give us awesome orgasms.
Yes. 13 in your case.
Yeah, I should love this thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's working for you.
Yeah, it really is.
You know, you may not be able to turn a doorknob after that, but like, I'm just going to lay here.
Again, I accomplished enough for the day if I can do that.
Yes, absolutely. Very productive.
Yes.
So we're almost out of time, mm-hmm. but I would love to hear your take on how folks can be allies to their friends or people that they know in the lesbian community.
Well, get up, stand up. Absolutely get out there. You know, we are not in a place right now that's safe. We are not in a place where we can afford people to be silent. But just with women in general, like women need your help. Women don't need your silence right now.
Right.
And for allies, I'd say the best thing to do is to communicate and to listen. I mean, honestly, I don't mind if anyone has any questions for me when they find out, when they do learn what my identity is. I'd love to handle it and ask them. But I also, you know, as opposed to telling me you're lesbian, for some straight dude, as opposed to telling me your lesbian fantasy, why don't you tell me about the gay fantasy you have?
Mm-hmm.
You know, try and communicate with me on a level that is pleasing and comfortable for me.
Right. Or even if it's not a gay fantasy, some piece of yourself that makes you feel vulnerable and sharing.
Yeah. And that's the number one thing too, is when you are a woman in this world and when you're a woman who is a queer woman, you are vulnerable. You're an egg out of the shell almost. So sharing that vulnerability with someone is very beautiful actually.
Yeah.
And really trying to connect. I'd say, of the guy friends that I do have, I consider them all male lesbians. And a big part of that is I really feel like they understand and are able to put themselves in a place to understand what a female experience in this world is.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't see it as they don't see me as an object of fetishization or someone to like co-rag on about women with, which is something I also get.
They're like, girls, Emma, right?
Yeah. And I'm like, no, you're not right. But geez.
So as a woman who dates women, what advice do you have about dating women for men who date women?
Talk more, goddammit.
About what? What are we talking about?
Open yourself up. Just if something, open yourself up. Ask how she's doing every day. Open yourself up to conversation. Don't be afraid to go to places that you don't want to go to. There's nothing that you're protecting by keeping your thoughts and your feelings like kind of bottled up in a way. And it's not, you know, again, it's also, you know, it's no one's winning in the game of a relationship. We're all just trying to get there together.
Right. Play like a team.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think it really, the idea that that shared vulnerability is such a great is like an essential tool in relationships and dating. You have to make the other person feel safe, be willing to like go stand out there on the limb with them a little
Absolutely.
Bit and not just make demands.
Yeah. Change too is a big one.
Yeah.
That's hard for, I think, anyone and everyone, but don't be afraid to change what you're doing in order to like make a life together with someone else.
Yeah.
Even if it's just like, hey, even if you're just together for a brief time during an encounter, you know, try something a little bit new. You might find that you like it.
Mm-hmm. I love that. That's great parting advice. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Insert Here. If you like our show, please find us on iTunes and write us a review. It really helps. You can listen online anytime at inserthere.fullserviceradio.org. Would you be a good guest, or do you know potentially good guests? Shoot us an email. We are at inserthereherepodcast@gmail.com. Stay horny.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org.